Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 568. And Mr. Moore, you want to give us a brief rundown on Senate Bill 568, please?
Mr. Chair, the committee, SB 568, expands membership to Oregon State Capital Foundation, staggers terms of office, and declares emergency effective on passage.
Senator Jackson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have with me David Henderson, who is Director of Legislative Administration, as you all know. We're here to testify on Senate Bill 568. This foundation was established during the last Legislative Assembly. And the idea of the foundation is, of the State Capital Foundation, is that we would like to be able to encourage people to contribute and to kind of the upkeep of the Capitol. The foundation was established, and the interesting thing about it, we found many, many people want to be involved in this and would like to serve on the foundation board. And we have the opportunity, we think, to get some heavy hitters, I guess you might say, who would be willing to serve on the board and who would help in fundraising and things like that to help with the improvement of the Capitol building itself. By the way, during last year, I had a chance to be in Vermont. And it's amazing what's happening in their capital, and their foundation really is doing a lot of exciting things there. So I came away saying, gee, our foundation needs to get on the ball and get moving. So we really have been kind of in limbo until we've had a chance to come back to the Legislative Assembly to see if we could add. And I think it changes the only change in this bill is that we want to move not fewer than 9 and not more than 25 members. So it's just a change of membership on the foundation board. And that's what we're here to ask you for today, to approve Senate Bill 568. And I don't know if Mr. Henderson has anything to add.
Just be happy to answer any questions.
We'd be happy. Let's get this moving, and we'd like to get this foundation operational.
Okay. What have been some of the current activities of the...
It's not been functional at this point.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Okay. Chair, questions from the committee? Yes.
I guess I'm just kind of curious as to why it hasn't been functional and why, what would make, how would this change make it functional?
Sure, go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, the Legislative Administration Committee started a process during the last interim to identify the 7 members that they would appoint to the committee. They succeeded in narrowing the list down to 14, and at that point, the talents and skills of the 14 people were also evident that they didn't want to lose the talents of 7 people by selecting 7 out of that 14, and felt that it was best to wait until they could expand the size of the foundation before they actually geared up activities.
Mr. Chair, okay. So what do you envision the foundation to do then if we do it then with traction and large it committee?
Well, we see the foundation being established. It can receive gifts, it can receive contributions, and of course there would be tax deductible gifts that can be given. And upkeep, and Dave, you may want to add some things here too that we could fix within the Capitol building.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, both capital improvements to the building as well as supporting celebrations that at this point we don't have a vehicle by which to raise money out of, say, corporate donors or individual donors who might wish to support, say, the Lewis and Clark celebration or something like that, that we're not able to get lottery dollars or general fund dollars or something of that nature. This would give us a vehicle to raise money to support those sorts of activities.
One more, Mr. Chair. So we're going to raise more money, but in the process of expanding the membership of this committee, we're going to spend a lot more money, too, because the committee members get per diem, mileage, travel to get here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, it does expand the membership, the number of legislators on the committee from 1 senator and 1 representative to 3 senators and 3 representatives, but we wouldn't anticipate such a significant number of meetings that would create a large fiscal impact. yes, the members would be eligible for per diem, but I would say that the foundation itself would meet maybe quarterly or maybe twice a year or something along those lines. And the non-legislators on the foundation, there's no provision to pay them per diem or mileage or any of their expenses.
So the questions from the committee?
Yeah, we have many people, like Senator Hatfield, and people who have been involved a long time who are anxious to get involved in this, and that's why we're anxious to move forward.
I have one more.
Yes, Mr. Barr.
Thank you. What happens then if we go down this road and you now have the committee was unwilling to narrow the field from 14 to 7 to expand the board, so now we can go up to 25, and now we have 28. Well, we're such excellent candidates we can't, so the committee can be unwilling to pair the field from 28 to 14 to proceed forward in 2 years before we come back and do it again?
Mr. Chair, we will be moving forward. We will be moving forward. I'm not going to let the administration, but we're not going to let that happen.
Yes, the questions in the committee?
Just our leadership. Our leadership.
Senator Duncan, could this improvements to the Capitol and such possibly mean larger offices on the House side?
There was some talk of cutting them in half, but I
thought... That was done last
year. We did that last
year.
Some discussion of that, but I'd rather not go into it right now, because I actually think I want to get this bill passed, and I'm not going to do any jeopardizes at this moment.
Do you have conference rooms being changed back into
offices?
Offices?
Mm-hmm. What's that again? I'm sorry.
I changed some conference rooms back into offices.
Oh.
In the house. Or the offices on the Senate side are so palatial and large that perhaps we could just squeeze a few House members down there.
Wait, you have to share my office with somebody. Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Along those same lines, since senators like to be more visible than House members. They like to be more visible than House members, so I do think we'll forward this proposal that senators' parking spaces will all be outside and that basement will all be for House members.
I feel it's time to 508 maybe 568 maybe falling apart. We need to click it back in here.
Well, Governor Gellin, I'd like to make a conceptual amendment to Bill 568.
Just keep in mind, you too could become a senator or something.
Far be it from me. Far be it from me, Mr. Senator. Okay.
Maybe if I had it.
Any further questions for Senator Duncan or Dave Henderson?
I might tell them years ago as a House member, we used to say that you really had to have one heart attack.
At least one heart attack under your belt. Anyone else in the audience who would like to come forward and testify today on Senate Bill 568? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 568 and open a work session on Senate Bill 568. Representative Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 568 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
You're going to forego the conceptual amendment regarding parking spaces and such?
Oh, yes, I will.
okay. Colleagues, we have a motion before us to move Senate Bill 568 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Mr. Chair? Representative Beyer?
I think I'll be a no.
Okay. Any further discussion? Kevin, please call the roll.
Representative Gardner? Aye.
Representative Manning? Aye. Representative Fisher? Aye. Representative Schwartz? Aye. Representative Welch? Aye. Representative Lloyd? Aye. A very vulnerable time for legislators. But I crushed my good colleague from Northeast Portland. I wasn't referring to you. Representative Edwards is excused. Thank you, Senator.
Can we have a volunteer for Carrier?
Mr. Vatkin.
Sure.
All right.
And for that one.
And did you see if Senator Miller is still out in the hall? He wanted to testify on Senate Bill 806.
See if you can get Representative Crump to dress like the Golden Man or something.
I could do that. I bet he'd do it. I'm talking to him.
Sorry.
The water on the roof.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The axe and the stuff behind it.
Yeah,
yeah. Stay on the roof.
Yeah, you've got to do something like
gold leather. Yeah, don't you think so?
Gold leather pants?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're bad today.
Okay, he's away from there. So we will go ahead and go to Senate Bill 558 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 558 and call Ethan Wilson. A couple letters you can see before you also, callers. Input that has been received from people around the state on Senate Bill 558. Please introduce yourself for the record, Lieutenant. And,
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Lieutenant Ethan Wilson with the Oregon State Police, Assistant Director of the Patrol Services Division. I'm here to express testify in opposition to Senate Bill 558. The state police is opposed to an increase in the speed limit on rural interstate highways on two fundamental points. One, we feel there is evidence to indicate that increasing the speed limit will result in more deaths. And the second is that the state police lack adequate patrols to enforce current speed limits. There's one study in particular that indicates that states that have gone to speed limits, increasing the speed limits, have resulted in a 15% on average increase in the number of deaths. This is based on information from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. We did a study on 24 states comparing basically looking at legislation from 1995, 1996 that increased the speed limit to higher than 55, and then they compared with other states that had not made any changes. The states that had not made any changes showed no change in their fatalities with regard to their interstate highways. Also, fundamentally, with higher speed, you get an increase in reaction and stopping distances. With higher speed, you get crashes that are more severe. There's more energy that's imparted in the collision. With a higher speed, you get the reduction in the ability of restraint systems to protect the occupants. From an enforcement standpoint, I believe you're all aware we're understaffed at this point. There's not enough resources for our agency, and we do have primary responsibility for patrol of the state and interstate highway systems. We do not currently have enough resources to change driver behavior. We believe that part of the relief that drivers are on average maybe going faster than 55 miles an hour on those rural interstate speed areas is that they know they can get away with. It doesn't mean right, it's just the 85th percentile though can be a moving target. As you increase the speed limits. Many drivers will continue to push that limit even with the increase. There's one NHTSA study that suggests that two-thirds of the motorists out there admit that at least occasionally they will drive at speeds faster than what they feel is safe, regardless of what it's posted. But what they feel, what their comfort level is, they'll drive faster than what their comfort level is. And with regard to the enforcement issue, I guess the short version is that we would need to increase patrols to provide the adequate coverage to offset some of the resulting driving behavior. from this legislation. That's all I have at this time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Lieutenant Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lieutenant Wilson. I just have a question. Currently, as you're aware, speeds out there, especially in I-5, that most of them drive on a regular basis. It could be the speeds there now clearly over the 65 mile an hour limit. And yet, sometimes when you're driving, someone will be in that fast left lane driving 65 miles an hour. Doesn't that create a dangerous, hazardous driving condition?
For a person to go on the speed limit at 65 in the left lane, it should not create a hazardous driving condition. Obviously, when you combine that with people that want to drive much faster, then they might do perform some driving acts that are maybe unjustified in trying to own the lane. One of the things that I've noticed in almost 16 years I've been on the road, it doesn't matter how fast the traffic's moving, the following distance is about the same. We do not adjust the following distance safely in accordance with the speed that they're traveling. But to answer your question, it could cause a hazard, but not necessarily at the fault of the person going 65 in the left lane.
We've heard stories about road rage and people frustrated, and I was like, roads get more crowded, more congested, people needing to get where they go in a quicker time. And in that same situation where you have somebody that's driving at 65 in the fast lane, doesn't that create more opportunity for that kind of aggressive behavior, that kind of what I would call inappropriate behavior to manifest itself?
Aggressive driving is actually a situation that's been occurring for quite some time. It's not, it's just somebody who finally put a name to it within the last 2-3 years. Aggressive driving can involve speed, it can involve the following too close, the unsignaled lane changes, a combination of inappropriate hazardous driving behavior, not necessarily because a person needs to get someplace faster. We're finding, and this may be a cultural issue, where they just want to get there faster. Whether the root of aggressive driving is can be pinned on the 65 mile an hour speed limit or not, I cannot draw that conclusion.
Yes, President Devlin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lieutenant, have you been involved in much traffic investigation in your past?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, yes, I have.
An 80,000-pound vehicle. Part of the letters that we've received in here, one of them is from a trucking operator that indicates that they're opposed to the bill, actually, because they feel, for a number of reasons, that raising the speed limit would increase fuel consumption, increase the potential liabilities, and et cetera. But one of the, think the other things they pointed out or alluded to is that vehicles of that size can't stop on a dime, so to speak. At 70 miles per hour, I don't know if you remember your tables here, how long would it take a vehicle like that to stop in terms of distance on dry pavement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I don't have figures in front of me as far as that size of the truck. I can give you rough estimates, and it's actually on a table that's included in a copy of my formal testimony that shows the stopping distances at various speeds. If you would like that.
Okay. Now, those distances would be greater on wet pavement, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
continue, Devlin.
Are any of the rural interstates, I'm trying to think of this, are any of them non-separated highways? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I'm not aware of any that are not separated in some way by at least a guardrail.
Okay.
Offhand, I'm not aware of any that are not separated.
Okay. Another follow-up. we've had testimony here that basically would indicate that the current speed limit, that people systematically exceed that by several miles per hour. Would you anticipate if we raise the limit that people will systematically exceed that by several miles per hour until they run into the potential for enforcement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I feel that they that after motorists are comfortable with an increased speed limit and they're comfortable driving at those speeds, that there will be a percentage that will continually exceed that limit, probably by several miles per hour, whatever they feel they can get away with under the circumstances.
Thank you.
I'm the one without a beard. Question for you. When was the speed limit raised from 55 to 65?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't specifically recall that. I was working the road at the time. I believe it was about 80. Seven. I'm not positive on that,
though. All seven. Just out of curiosity, do you know if the state police oppose that raising the speed limit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't know offhand. I was not involved in the process at that point.
And last question.
Representative Edwards.
We heard testimony initially when this bill was introduced that a lot of the road freeways were designed for higher speeds. Do you agree or disagree with that statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't have the fundamental knowledge to respond to that. I don't have any engineering background with regard to design capabilities for the highways. I'm sorry, I can't address that.
Representative Edwards.
Again, I think, if I recall, I grew up in Eastern Washington. A lot of those freeways, when they were put in, the speed limits were up to what we're talking about here. So I guess they were designed for something. Particularly around the Boardman area, one of the straightest lines I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Outside of I'm in Utah. You go west, the Vegas straight line. But anyway, just hear from else you know when that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the only information that I have heard is that originally they were possibly designed for those speeds, but it was a very long time ago when that design was initially done, and the traffic, the daily traffic counts were much different. They were much lower, and those are much higher now. And that would probably, my guess would be that would really skew the formula at this point as far as what those engineering studies might or might not recommend as far as the speed.
Thank you.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at your written testimony, and I see you've got the chart in the back. I'm assuming you use the same size car when you're calculating your stopping distance and your foot pound. Is that be a valid statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, these figures are not something that I personally came up with. This was based on information through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And the information was obtained actually from their website where they discussed this issue specifically with regard to stopping distance. I do not know what the circumstances of that particular test were at this point. I can't address if they used the same vehicle or I could only make an assumption and that can be dangerous sometimes. So.
Yeah, I guess I just find it curious. I'm not a master in physics, but when you increase the your velocity by 50%, you're increasing your energy by 200%. It doesn't seem like it's physics, but I don't know. I just
maybe somebody else is a youth maker sometimes, but
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, I know that that's also mentioned in the newspaper article that the crash severity increases by the square of the speed. I'm no mathematician, but I believe that that's probably one of the ways that they came up with their energy formula on their calculations.
Lieutenant Wilson, I believe it was about 1975, 1976, when we reposted the speed limit at 55 miles per hour due to an oil shortage in the United States as an energy conservation measure. And prior to that time, as I recall, the speed limit was posted at 75 miles an hour. We have had some increase in traffic. However, our cars are considerably safer today than they were in an earlier day. In compiling your testimony, did you take into account the fact that we are budgeting for an additional 100 state troopers in this session of the legislature?
Mr. Chair, yes, I have.
Can you still consider that inadequate for goals to enforce a 75-mile-an-hour speed limit?
Mr. Chair, yes, on the principle that the 100 troopers would represent roughly just under one quarter of our identified gap of the additional troopers that communities have identified as a need for state police services. Of the 100 troopers that are in proposing our budget currently, 55 of those troopers would be assigned to freeway offices, and the other 45 would be assigned to areas to other stations that are non-freeway stations because of the priorities they have in their jurisdiction.
Is it just a policy of the Oregon State Police to be generally opposed to an increase in the speed limit?
Mr. Chair, fundamentally, with regard to this issue, I would have to say yes.
Mr. Chair.
Lieutenant Kirby.
Thank you. So you believe from your experience that driving at 75 is that much more of a safety hazard than driving at 65? From your field experience, you believe it makes a considerable amount of difference?
Mr. Chair, Representative Piercy, yes. If we would oppose legislation that would that might result in any way might result in the loss of even one more life.
Okay. And do you believe, if I might follow, do you think that given the current level of supervision we have, that seems to me that at the current speed we have a tough time having the kind of supervision we need to keep people driving at the current speed, and that we if we elevated that speed, you would probably expect to have the same people driving 10 to 15 miles over that we seem to have right now, and that's what I think it is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Piercy, I believe those speeds, and as I stated, I believe they would go up, and they would go up above 75 miles an hour,
mm-hmm.
particularly after a time when the motorists were got comfortable driving at those with the new speed limit. Some of them would be quite comfortable because they're already driving
right.
75 anyway.
So. Right. So no matter what speed we have, people at least until we can do something about the monitoring on the highway, it seems to me that people are going to be tending to drive above that limit no matter what the speed is.
Representative Simmons, Chief Chair, Representative Percy, yes, I believe that would be the case.
Lieutenant Wilson, in Idaho, the speed limit is close to 75 miles an hour, and the people seem to travel along about 75 miles an hour. Do they have greater enforcement? My family and I go to Boise quite often, and I get a lot of complaints from people in Northeast Oregon about our speed limit being close to 65 when they get across the line into Idaho, they can go 75 legally.
And people seem to be somewhat comfortable at traveling along at 75. I haven't noticed it to be true, at least in the other states that I've been able to travel in. They have a higher posted limit. I haven't noticed it to be true that people are just universally creeping 5 to 10 miles an hour over the posted limit.
Mr. Chair, I can't speak to Idaho's experience. In actuality, I've only been through Idaho once, and it was not on an interstate. It was across the panhandle. And I cannot speak to Idaho's circumstance or and I don't have any anecdotal information as far as the other states with regard to their comfort level or their compliance other than what I've already stated to you.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Lawson, another question for you. You mentioned yourself that you weren't a traffic engineer. Do you believe, though, that our interstates could be engineered to allow for safe travel at 30 miles an hour?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, it may be possible to do that. I don't think it's so much a question of engineering necessarily on that as it is driver behavior. You're still going to have a percentage of the population that is going to follow too close, make unsignaled lane changes in heavy traffic, and create the kinds of problems that that do lead to crashes. And if they're going faster because of a higher speed limit, the results of those crashes could be more severe.
Just another question, Lieutenant Wilson. Do you believe the Department of Transportation has the engineering capability to study those issues to determine whether or not are capable of having traffic travel at 30 miles an hour?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, I'm sure they can do the studies to determine whether or not 75 would be safe, but outside of that, I don't have any.
Any further questions of Lieutenant Wilson? Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
We're going to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 558. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 806 and call Senator Miller. I just want to give us a brief review of what Senate Bill 806 is about.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 806 relieves the requirement that election petition secretary be registered voters, relieves the requirement that signatures seats in this reform petition contain notice indicating the person circulating petitions is being paid. Specifies a statement of expenditures filed in connection with initiative or referendum petition must list full amounts spent for purpose of obtaining signatures. Specifies a statement is not required to list name and address of the petition circulator or amount paid to each circulator.
Thank you, Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fortuitous, I was here just for the closing of the testimony of 558, and I would just offer you these comments before I get to 806. All I would ask the panel to do is vote like you drive. Just remember that 34 states have heard all of the negative testimony and they have voted to increase the speed limit. So they've heard it, they've analyzed it, and rejected it. So I urge you to do the same. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, Senate Bill 806, this bill addresses a recent United States Supreme Court decision concerning the constitutionality of certain election laws in Colorado. The court's opinion, known as Buckley v. American Constitutional Law Foundation, was handed down on January 12, 1999. It declares unconstitutional a number of Colorado's initiative petition regulations. Many of those regulations struck down are similar to statutes Oregon applies to the initiative process. The Supreme Court, in that case, invalidated Colorado's provision in its constitution that requires petition circulators to be registered voters. Oregon has a similar requirement in state law, ORS 260.560. This statute can no longer be enforced. Colorado also had a statute that required initiative petition circulators to wear identification badges, which included the circulator's name and address, and disclosed whether or not the circulator was paid or was a volunteer. The court struck down the requirements of name and address While Oregon has no similar requirement, it is clear it cannot require one in the future. And finally, the Supreme Court invalidated part of Colorado's contribution and expenditure reporting requirements. It found that the state lacks sufficient justification to warrant the reporting of the names, addresses, and amounts paid to circulators. The court did uphold the Colorado requirement that signature sheets be submitted together with a notarized affidavit from each circulator. The affidavit included the circulator's name and address and verified that the circulator had read and understood the laws governing the circulation of petitions. Oregon's counterpart statute requires chief petitioners to file a complete contribution and expenditure report 15 days after the filing deadline for state initiatives. This report included the name of each payee and the amount and purpose of the expenditure. The Buckley decision invalidates those requirements. Senate Bill 806 addresses the Buckley opinion. It deletes from the Oregon Revised Statute the requirement that chief petitioners need not list the name or address of any person as payee or the amount paid to any person. It also repeals the requirement that circulators must be registered voters in the state of Oregon. Clearly, in light of the Buckley decision, this bill should be adopted. Mr. Chairman, let me state that I am pleased that I just recited the testimony of Secretary of State Kiesling before the Senate committee that passed this bill. And I did that because when we had a discussion on the Senate floor about this bill, there was a significant dissent on that bill among people who frankly disagreed, in my judgment, with what the Supreme Court of the United States did. But all I am telling you, if you disagree with Senate Bill 806, please write Chief Justice Rehnquist and the other eight members of the United States Supreme Court. It is not the fault of Senate Bill 806. And I would just simply say that if we continue to carry on these statutes, they are unenforceable and meaningless and probably problematic for those people who try to adhere to things that are unconstitutional. So I would just simply ask you to pass Senate Bill 806 to clean up the statutes and remove these things that are unconstitutional as determined by the United States Supreme Court.
Thank you, Senator.
In this testimony, you talked about that the report says that you don't have to have the name of the payee or the amount or the purpose of the expenditure. But does that mean also that you can't just indicate that the petitioner is being paid? Is that out as well?
You need not, according to the Supreme Court, it struck down the requirement that the circulator have the name and address, but the court did not express an opinion as to the other elements.
So you could potentially still have the part in there that says this person is a paid petitioner.
I think you could do that. It has not been decided. We know from experience, for example, in the last election cycle, we have a situation with one of the measures, the vote by mail measures, where the petitions indicated that there weren't paid petitioners. Indeed, the facts are there were.
Mm-hmm.
There was no penalty for having used paid circulators, and so it almost rendered the requirement meaningless.
If I may, I think it's simply, though, if it were to continue to exist, it would simply let people know. I mean, there's no penalty. It would simply let people know that these particular gatherers were getting paid as opposed to being volunteers, if that had some influence on whether they wanted to sign the petition or not.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Percy, there are obviously many ways to indicate that, whether it's on the report that will still be filed with respect to how you finance this whole operation. That still is required, even under 806.
but it's just the details and of the individual payee that is determined to be unconstitutional.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Edwards?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Miller, for returning with another bill. Let me ask you.
Your name's not on this one.
And again, not on this one. You left me out. A question. Do you know what the intent was and when specifically the language was put in on page 2, line 16, addressing aid collection? Person obtaining a signature on the petition is displaying that they are being paid. Do you know when that was put into law?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Edwards, I'm sure I was here during that debate. I think it was in the late 80s, perhaps. I think the time of Senator from Hillsborough, who has since departed, I think was very instrumental in that being placed in the statute.
Maybe not be so specific about the debate, but was the debate somehow that by having that displayed, and I think what the Chris is getting at is whether the court addressed that issue, but do you have an opinion whether that, what was the policy discretion and whether or not taking this out really hasn't been effective? I guess I'm trying to get a sense of, I'm still open-minded whether or not displaying that makes a difference, whatever that difference was, is intended.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, I believe, as an observer of election does, or each of you, people have a variety of reasons for supporting or opposing particular measures. So to me, the threshold question is what is contained within the measure. I am not as concerned as to how it gets before it. Therefore, I'm not all excited about whether or not one uses paid signature gatherers or it is an entire volunteer effort. And as I cited earlier, in the case of the vote by mail, it was gathered by paid signature gatherers to some degree, and yet it wasn't so indicated, so I'm not sure what to make of that. But I would tell you this, that the detractors of a particular idea, in my view, will find a reason to oppose it, and they will often say, well, this is brought by those big paid forces who are getting this on the ballot, and they seem to ignore the fact that Oregonians still have the judgment to make as to whether or not the idea that was brought before them is any good. So I just kind of worry about that aspect, and it's not something, in my view, that needs to be continued to be in statute. The instruction of the Legislative Council when I had this drafted was just make our laws conform to the Supreme Court decision.
And just to follow up, and hence they took that section out. So we can blame LC and not you, Senator.
Right.
Blame LC, blame the courts. I'm sure you can blame me too, but that's all right.
I won't do that on the record.
I just take note on that same page, or before on page 2, before the deleted part, it does still look to me like it still retains that if one or more persons will be paid for obtaining signatures, that there is a notice saying that some circulators to the petition are being paid, it would still be present even if you deleted this other section. So there's at least you would have an indication.
Correct. Great. Any other questions for Senator Miller? Senator Miller, I just have one quick one. We got a letter from Secretary of State Cheeseman, and he requested that we add an additional amendment to this bill that would the minimum age requirement for circulators is 18 years. Do you have a problem with amending that into this bill?
Mr. Chairman, that would not be something I would desire to do in this particular bill. That probably should have a discussion, and that's up to this committee, but all by itself. Again, as I stated to Representative Edwards, I'm not really all that concerned about how a measure gets put before the voters of this state. I have confidence in their judgment, and so I don't really worry whether or not somebody was 17, 18, 19, whatever their employment circumstance might be, paid, volunteer. It doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is the idea.
Thank you. Okay, William.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Miller, to follow up on that last question, if we were to send a separate bill over, not buttering this bill, but send a separate bill over that did put a 18-year-old requirement for petition signature gatherers Would you oppose that bill in the Senate?
Well, first it would go to the Rules Committee on our side, chaired by the extraordinarily able Senator Starr.
Assuming he gave that a hearing.
I do not know his position on that. I know we had some discussion of this issue on the Senate side, and we weren't excited to include it at that time. So my guess is it might not succeed. But
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the courtesy.
Great.
Any other, any audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 806? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 806, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 806.
Here.
Representative Beyer.
Move Senate Bill 806 to the floor of the Duke House.
We've got a motion on the floor, members. Colleagues. Representative Piercy.
I actually would like to know from Legislative Council why they chose to delete this, because it doesn't seem to me to be an issue that relates to what needed to be taken out.
Well, it just so happens we have an able Legislative Council to answer your question.
Thank you. For the record, Sid Reutling, Legislative Council. I'm assuming that you're talking about the section on a petition sheet that requires a statement that says this petitioner is being paid.
That's exactly right.
Part of the Supreme Court decision that Senator Miller was talking about struck down the Colorado requirement that required the CNE reports to list the name and the address of the person who is being paid to circulate signatures. And the key point for the court there was the identification of the person who's being paid to circulate. They said if the state didn't have a good enough interest in requiring that information, that that required the paid petitioner to surrender their anonymity, the anonymity that somebody who wasn't being paid would have to circulate the petition. So we thought that this language needed to come out because the bottom of each sheet, circulators are required by law to sign the sheet, and those sheets do become public record and are held at the Secretary of State's office. Therefore, it would be possible by looking at those sheets to identify those people who were paid to circulate petitions. And we believe legally that that wouldn't fly if challenged because of the Supreme Court decision, which said that you can't require the disclosure of the names of the people who are being paid. So that's how we got there.
Okay. I think it's a few to three, but nonetheless, I'll come up.
Any further discussion?
Yes.
Are we losing a quorum?
One, two, three, four, five, six. Yes, we are. And that's me. Yes.
If there's no discussion, I think we'll have to have a quick call roll.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Without being too obvious, if we've got two no votes and only eight members here, we have a problem.
Back in work session on Senate Bill 806, and Kevin, I understand you were in the process of calling the roll on Senate Bill 806. And if there are perhaps members here who were not here when you started the roll call, would you please capture them?
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse?
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Mann?
Aye.
Representative Casey?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Welsh?
No,
not that, but
anyway.
Representative
Williams?
Aye. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Change my vote from no to aye.
We've
moved the House with a due tax recommendation. We need a carrier.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Devlin.
Senator Miller is my corresponding senator, and we work so closely together on issues. I'll carry this one.
All right. 3568.
No.
Well, it's time for Senator Devlin as a carrier.
All right. So we will close the work session on Senate Bill 806.
We have a work session.
Here's 2776 while we're here.
It's a work session only today. Senate Bill 2776 is. We currently have a suspended public hearing on Senate Bill 558 moving along. Let's go ahead and jump into House Bill 2776. Mr. Moore, please bring us up to date.
All right, committee members, 2776. You should have in your possession dash 3 amendments. And a dash 2 amendment.
Dash 1.
1.
Dash 1. 1 you've already had before the committee.
And review for us the dash 1 2s and 3s, which you missed.
Okay. Dash 1 amendment estimates for a state measure to be initiated printed on the signature sheets, a disclosed financial impact printed on the signature sheets, and filing dates for petition. My record says correct, Mr. Chair. That's the one that has no weight. Is that correct, Mr. Matt?
That's correct. Okay.
So dash 3 arrived just before committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Who brought us the dash 1 and dash 2 and the dash 3?
Pardon me?
Who brought us each one of these amendments?
Mr. Chairman,
with him, Mary.
Part of that question, I brought you the dash 2 and the dash 3.
Okay.
I don't know who brought the dash 1, but they were in my crosshair as soon as I saw them. Mr. Chairman, may I?
Yes, with him, Mary.
To get us rolling, I move adoption of the dash 3 amendments. If I may, I'll explain the motion.
We have a motion before colleagues to move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2776. Representative Mannix.
What I was trying to do last time when we were up on this bill was to deal with the issue of the delay that one might find if one consulted the legislative council and the time frame that might be involved there. And in order to address that issue and to sort of provide a trade-off, I addressed the issue of, well, what if we allowed someone to circulate the petition based on the certified ballot title? The dash 2 amendments were evolved to allow you to begin circulating a petition with the Attorney General certified ballot title on it, and then if there was litigation and the Supreme Court came down with a new certified ballot title, that you would then switch within 30 days to that petition. And that seemed to be a nice way to give some incentive to folks to use legislative counsel to help them. But at the same time, say, to make up for the fact that that ate up some of the time, that they could also start sooner than usual in case someone tried to litigate their ballot title. Secretary of State Keeson came to me after we introduced the dash 2s and said, look, you're creating confusion for the Secretary of State. They'll have two types of, you know, they're going to have to deal with questions as to which petitions are okay and which ones are not. So the dash 3 addressed the issue differently. The dash 3 say this. you go through this process with legislative council and consultation as originally proposed in the bill. And when you get your certified ballot title from the Attorney General, you may elect to use that as a ballot title on your petitions, all of your petitions, and start circulating them so you can get out there whether or not it's being litigated. Remember, this is the ballot title, not the petition title, but somehow over the years we've gotten used to the idea that the ballot title is on the petition. Well, this time it might be slightly different from what ends up being on the ballot if there's litigation, but you get out there. You're going to have, the circulators will have the measure with them, or they'll have the actual measures on the petition. So people will be able to see the actual content of what they're signing. But the certified ballot title is at least an independent determination by the Attorney General as to what the petition is all about. On the other hand, Bill Sizemore complained to me saying he didn't want to start using the Attorney General certified ballot title. He wanted to wait until the Supreme Court had ruled so he could see if he wanted to circulate the petition. Okay, well, let's go both ways. If you want to get out at the beginning of a shoot, you may use the Attorney General's certified ballot title on your petition and start circulating your petition. And on the other hand, if you don't care and you want to wait till litigation is over and use the Supreme Court ballot title, fine, but then you wait. You use one or the other. That takes care of Mr. Keesling's concern about having different petition language on the ballot title that might confuse his staff or the public. At the same time, it takes care of Mr. Sizemore's concern about, hey, he wants to wait until he's sure he has a ballot title he really likes and then circulate. Fine. And at the same time, it takes care of the concern of people who want to get out to shoot early and get their petitions around in exchange for having gone through this legislative council consultation process. So it's designed to be a panacea for all involved in the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Representative Manick. I believe I know the process, but currently the signature gatherers cannot start gathering signatures until all litigation on the ballot title is finalized. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I
personally am not interested in moving either the dash threes or the bill in its original form. I don't think that we want to have this option out there of people not knowing what the ballot title is going to be. I think all litigation has to be finalized before petitions are gathered. So I personally don't like the dash one, two, three, or the original bill. So that's where I am.
Representative Beck.
So if you use the Attorney General ballot title, you gather signatures, Supreme Court comes up, or Supreme Court rules that title invalid, your signatures wouldn't be invalid. That would just be the ballot title that's on the ballot.
That's correct.
Okay.
And if you look back historically, if I may, Mr. Chairman? Historically, the Supreme Court changes a word or two or three or four, maybe, after all this litigation. I understand how that's important to some people because that's what appears on the ballot. And this legislation won't change what's on the ballot. But we've always had this process where you had to have your ballot title before you could circulate your petition. And this says, well, you do have to have one, a certified one. But it may not be the ultimate one that the Supreme Court approves. And I think there may be one person out of 10,000 who would notice the difference. But the circulators would notice the opportunities to get out there in exchange for this other opportunity to confer with legislative council to get at the issue we're trying to get at here, which is to have better drafted measures. It's called the inducement.
That's what I was trying to figure out how to do in the last bill.
If you were talking about incenting people, I'd rather talk about incenting.
Well.
There you have it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Max. We did have this posted on the schedule today as public hearing and possible work session, but we do not have a sign-up sheet in the back. Anyone in the audience who is to testify today on the dash 3 amendments of House Bill 2776?
I know that the counsel for the legislative council is with us today. I guess I'd be interested in whether or not he has an opinion that the the legal process or any possible ramifications that agrees with that if adopted. This is 2776 is Representative Shetterly and my original bill. I'm amenable to the amendments being proposed by Representative Maness on the bill, but I guess I want to make sure that in doing so, we're not jeopardizing process-wise anything by doing so. So I guess I'd like maybe Mr. Reutlinger to come forward as the election law expert.
If you would, please.
Mr. Chair, Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Council's office. I don't see that there's any real legal issue with this particular approach taken in the Dash 3 amendments. The current law now simply requires that you wait until the Supreme Court has certified the final title before you go out. And the law requires that only the cover of the initiative petition contain the full ballot title, and it requires the signature sheets themselves only to contain the captions of the title. The real significance of this is that you would potentially have petitions out there that are containing the ballot title and the caption of the ballot title that are in different stages. You could have one petition that has just the Attorney General certified title on it, and then a bunch of other petitions that have the court title on them.
May I interrupt, please?
Representative Maness?
Aren't you required to use one or the other in the Dash 3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maness, yes, you are. What I'm talking about is separate petitions on different issues.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In other words, you could have a petition that has the certified title from the AG. I could have one where I waited and I have court's title. Or I could have one, I choose the certified title from the AG, you take me to court, the court certifies a different title. I'm out there circulating with the original title. As you pointed out, it may be slightly different when it gets on the ballot and in the voter's pamphlet, but the fact is I have certified a title or circulated a title that's slightly different from what the court would ultimately say the title is. That's really, as far as I can see, the only legal significance of these amendments. They don't change any other timelines, as far as I can see.
Mr. Reutlinger, this can open a can of worms as far as potential litigation around this issue.
Mr. Chair, I really can't see that it would. It seems to me the only challenge someone might make is the fact that they could claim that they were somehow misled because the petition itself had a ballot title on it that was different from the one that the court ultimately certified. But you know, this is, all of these procedures are simply creatures of statute, and it seems to me that you can make the rules be kind of what you want them to be. I don't see that there's any real issue involved in if you say that people can circulate petitions with the title that's certified by the AG.
Christian Blue?
Yeah. I'm satisfied with Ms. Reutlinger's answer to my question, which I think you expressed as well in your last question. I think that a person who is circulating petitions with a title that has not been determined by the court, they do so at their own peril, with the potential sort of marketplace risk that will come from being accused at some point and the possibility to campaign. That they circulated with a petition that was not, in fact, the certified ballot title, and could cause people in that process to start to mistrust and doubt how the thing ever got on the ballot in the first place. And I think those kinds of risks and potential accusations in the nature of the campaign may exist, but people who are circulating those petitions will know that. They'll take that risk. And I'm comfortable with Mr. Reutlinger's answer that he doesn't believe that there's going to be substantial litigation resulting out of this, and if we avoid that, then I think this amendment offered by Representative Maness is not an unfriendly amendment to the bill, and I would support it.
Further questions or discussion from the committee? Mr. Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, given that we have an attorney that says that he wants to avoid litigation, I think we should proceed with all due haste.
Thank you. It does appear to me that it will make it easier to get out and get your signatures collected. And that is what the Dastley Amendment basically enables.
May I suggest something else, too?
Yes, Mr. Manning.
I think it would also reduce the two-bill litigation we have right now where people challenge the ballot title only to delay circulation, because then the circulators may say, well, that's okay, go ahead and challenge me for the next 6 months, but I get to go on the AG-certified ballot title anyway. They may choose not to, but at least they have that option.
I have a few personal concerns in that the initiative process has been used as a club to beat rural communities about the head and shoulders competitively. And in some cases, I would cheer on people litigating to slow down the process. And if we pass this bill as is, it will remove one avenue that I have to keep things like Measure 64 off the ballot.
That's true.
Let's see, Max.
Some of us have stuck out our heads or necks or whatever and supported an earlier measure which went to the floor, which increases the number of signatures required for constitutional amendments in exchange for a very slight decrease on the statutory side. So in balance, you're still making progress.
There's a bit of a trade-off, isn't it? Griffin Williams?
Mr. Chairman, I guess, and I recognize and have a certain amount of compassion for the point that you've just raised, but I really think the fundamental purpose for Senate Bill 2776, which Representative Shetterly and I brought, is to really try to avoid the initiatives making it onto the ballot with no real review or input in trying to make them as good as they possibly can be from a structural standpoint, when presented to the people for a policy vote. And I think the great damage that has been done as a result of poorly drafted initiatives in this process is to essentially cause many Oregonians to doubt the process of government, because they see these initiatives go to the court, they're determined to be unconstitutional, or they're full of legal challenges, or we have to fix them at the legislative level because they weren't right. And that undermines generally, I think, people's support, not just of the initiative process, but quite frankly, all the other branches of government. So I recognize your concerns, but I think this actually is going to improve the system if it's used appropriately. And I'll point out as well that we still have the issue of fiscal impact. We're asking legislative council to do something that they're not currently funded to do, so that we're going to have to get a ways and means referral. And if members of the committee can support this, I just ask for their continued support in trying to find what really is a very small amount of money in the great scheme of things when it goes down into the boundary.
I believe this bill didn't come from the Speaker's office for the subsequent referral to ways and means. Have the amendments been submitted for analysis at first call?
I'm not sure the position on
it. Mr. Chairman, I have a fiscal impact statement that shows $172,000 impact for the 9901 binding. Would be actually half that now? Well, if that puts us under the $100,000 mark, then we don't have to refer it. Is that right?
$50,000.
Did you make it a quarter of that, Mr. Chairman?
I'm going to just ask a question. I don't think it's fair.
Chair?
Yes, Mr. Beck.
I've now talking to some thoughtful people on this subject, and what I was trying to accomplish in this previous bill, I think, could be maybe even more appropriately accomplished in this bill. A number of the items that the Supreme Court has ruled unconstitutional, maybe as an incentive for utilizing an attorney general ballot title, we would ask the petitioners agree to
basically go back and do some of the things that are currently required under Oregon law, and maybe even add something to the effect of require signature gatherers to wear a badge that says, I'm a paid signature gatherer, if in fact they are.
That's the decision I briefly proved that.
Well, but if this would be a voluntary basis, they'd be required to, if they, under our law, maybe Legal Eagles could help me figure out whether we're straying.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to suggest that Mr. the Representative Dick find his own bill. The third bill he's trying to pick on today. Right? Let's find him his own bill.
With all due respect, both my bills don't get hairy.
Now, Representative Dick, we just had a meeting about one of your bills today.
Yeah, no, I know, and I appreciate that. I don't know that it would necessarily be unconstitutional if we're simply granting a new avenue for people to have a different type of ballot title, and we're saying if you want to use this new ballot title, all we ask is that you do these other things. Otherwise, you can choose to go the traditional route, in which case you would not then be compelled to notify your, you know, tell the public anything about your signature gathering operation.
All righty, Mr. Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I know that Representative Jack is well intentioned. but it appears to me that what you're basically saying is if you will agree to comply with requirements that the court has found to be unconstitutional, we will grant you greater flexibility in the initiative process,
mm-hmm.
which appears to me, well, I'm not an attorney, it appears to me that you've got a problem, because now you're granting one group of individuals greater rights than another based on them complying with requirements that the court has found to be unconstitutional.
First, Chair, it's the choice they're making.
With all due respect, I think we need to get back to the measure of the motion in front of us, which is the adoption of the Dodd-Frank Amendment. And I'm willing to see it fly or crash on its own merit.
I mean, Mr. Chairman, I would give an example. It would be like saying if you were going, if it's not a good example, but if you're going to a police officer and they wanted to, and they wanted to search your car, and he said, if you voluntarily agree to search this car, we will limit our search to these areas. But if you don't voluntarily agree to search this car, we get a warrant and we won't limit it. I mean, it appears we need to.
Well, I do sense some unease with certain members of the committee with the Dastry amendment to House Bill 2776. So we have a motion before us. I'll give you the alternative, Representative Manning, of have an opportunity to lobby some of the members.
You want me to withdraw the motion for now, Mr. Chairman?
I'm going to give you the option.
Well, I appreciate the option, but I'm willing to let this baby fly or crash on her own merits, and I will not be offended. I hope you'll vote for it on the merits, but if you don't want to, that's okay. I won't be offended. I appreciate that. She flies with her own limb.
You know what I'm saying? We do.
Kevin, you call the roll.
Representative Edwards?
Excused.
Representative
Gardner? Aye. Representative Minnick?
Aye.
Representative Scarf?
Aye.
Representative
Welch?
No.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Chair Smith? No. Motion carries. We have the House 2776 as amended before, and we need to send it down to Ways and Means. Do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Well, either way, go ahead, Kevin.
I move that we refer the bill to Ways and Means of the due pass as amended.
Dupac's recommendation.
Dupac's recommendation is amended down to Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Chairman. I'd ask that it be sent with the revised fiscal so we can issue the lower number.
This is 80,000.
Yeah.
85,000.
I hope you can call the roll, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, we'll call the roll. And any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, yes. I'd propose it go without recommendation.
Would you offer an amendment to the motion then? Do you have an amendment offered to the motion to send this bill to Ways and Means without recommendation for discussion on the amendment? Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chairman, I'd oppose Representative Welch's amendment. I'd like to go down with recommendation. Obviously, folks, no one's talking about it. Let's just call the roll and say, I won't make those.
Vote it. Kevin?
Mr. Chair, what are we voting on now?
The amendment, you amend the motion from due pass to no recommendation.
Yes.
No.
Yes. Motion carried. So the motion is before us to move the bill to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion on the motion? Call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Byers?
No.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Hirschy?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Welch?
No.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Chair Simmons?
Aye.
The bill goes to Ways and Means. The due pass recommendation. We'll close the work session on Bill 2776 and go back into public hearing on Senate Bill 558. We have a list of people signed up to, and I need to jump out for a few moments. Yeah. Do you have a silent screen now? Yeah.
So there's members here from ODOT who wish to testify on that. Please come forward. I didn't have your name on the sheet in front of me. Please come forward. Please identify yourself. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Fisher. I work for Oregon Department of Transportation, ODOT, in the capacity of a state traffic engineer. And I would like to offer some testimony on Senate Bill 558 today. Basically, my testimony is a summary of how we have reviewed the bill, and it's a summary of what we believe the bill does, and a couple of discussion items. As we've read it and interpreted, the bill changes the maximum speed limits on rural interstates to 65 miles an hour for trucks and 75 miles an hour for passenger vehicles. It repeals the federal maximum speed limit on highways in accordance with changes already made by the federal government. It creates limits for posted speeds. It allows the Transportation Commission, OTC, to set speeds lower than the maximum on interstate freeways based on engineering and traffic investigations. And it also allows the OTC to raise or lower speeds on other state highways again with engineering and traffic investigation. Additional discussion. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety reports that motor vehicle deaths have been higher on roads in the 24 states that they have reported that have raised speed limits on interstates and freeways. They've also reported that deaths did not tend to increase on interstates and freeways in states where speed limits have not been raised. Further, in summary, Senate Bill 558 raises the rural interstate speed limit and will require replacement of some signs. ODOT is concerned about the effect this change would have on public safety. If speeds go up on rural interstates, additional enforcement will be necessary. And that concludes my testimony. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Any questions for Mr. Fisher?
Yeah. So you're not taking an official stand, just staying kind of neutral on this? I don't.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welsh, that's Mr. Chair.
And we have, what, a 70-mile-an-hour in California and Washington?
That's correct.
And what is Idaho, you know?
They have a maximum of 75.
It's 75.
Any other questions? Mr. Pistolas?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Deputy Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Pistolas. I'm manager of the Transportation Safety Division for ODOT. I have 4 points that I would like to raise, and also Dr. John Tung, an orthopedic surgeon from the Fulton area, is on his way. He was expecting to be here at the start of the committee, but is tied up in the backup traffic from the fatal traffic crash from this morning. I was paged about 5 minutes ago, and he said hopefully he'll try and be here within the next 5 minutes or so. Hopefully we can add him to the testimony roster as well. 4 points that I would like to raise. First, when evaluating the availability of emergency medical services times in relationship to severe injury and fatal crashes and so forth, in urban settings, emergency medical services ability to be notified, arrive on the scene, and get to a local trauma center in urban settings averages 36 and a half minutes. In a rural setting, notification, arrival to the scene, and arrival to a trauma center averages 59 minutes. Many of you may have heard of something called the golden hour, and that is if emergency medical services or medical treatment can be provided to a patient of any trauma injury within the hour, their chances of survival are that much greater. And just as a fact that there are not as many emergency medical service providers in the rural parts of the state, and their response time is longer, and just offering that as a point of fact. Second, passed out to you a public opinion survey for the state of Oregon. The question asked of those on a statewide basis, if the limit of 65 miles per hour is on rural interstate, do you favor or oppose raising the speed limit? In 1996, 62% opposed asking for an increase in the rural speed limit. Dropped 61% in 1997, and this last May of 1998, rose to 67% opposed raising 65 mile per hour rural interstate speed limit. The second paragraph below this graph, you note that residents of Region 3, which is Southern Oregon, and Region 4, which is Central Oregon, and respondent 65 years of age and older, opposed higher than this percentage raising the 65 mile per hour speed limit on rural interstate highways. Third point I'd like to bring to your attention is that raising interstate speeds has an effect on those connecting roads, highways, county roads, in some cases city streets, that drivers will carry their speeds further into the connecting roads, which are not designed to handle a higher speed. And during the last hearing, you heard a statement of data indicating that 85% of the motoring public exceed the 65-mile-an-hour limit. That is an incorrect fact. The 85% indicates that the driving public is going 71 miles per hour or lower. That is what the 85th percentile measure indicates in the engineering studies. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I conclude my remarks. You have to answer any questions.
Any questions for Howard?
I have a bit of a comment. Speed isn't the only issue with weather as it relates to crashes. I recall one night a couple semi-trucks wrecked right in front of my wife and I, and we stayed there with the driver for 2 full hours before anybody showed up. He was up over Meacham with the internal on the grant. And it's because of ice, it wasn't because of speed. And I don't encourage anyone to drive faster than conditions will allow. What is the your poll here? Just on a scientific basis, margin of error, what would that be?
Mr. Chair, this poll has a plus or minus 3% margin of error. It is a statewide coverage, statistically valid for statewide, and also the five regions as described in the ODOT distribution of staffing.
Mr. Chair.
Isn't that?
How big was the sample size?
1,000.
Mr. Chair, Representative Axton, I believe the sample size is 4,000 individuals.
Was that evenly distributed among the regions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, it was distributed to be specifically valid in all five regions and statewide.
What was the respondents favorable or disfavorable in regions 3 and 4 that were under the ages of 65?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, I'd be happy to provide this. You did not bring a copy of that page with me.
Do you have any corresponding data that would suggest that the members that did participate in the survey drive?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, that is one of the qualifiers for those asked the series of questions, is that they have a valid license and do drive.
Who did the survey?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, Intercept Research Corporation conducts a survey on our behalf on multiple safety issues every year during May and June. It has done so for more than 10 years.
What other questions were part of the survey?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, it covers issues such as the individual recognizing public service announcements, the individual's opinions on those things that would make their streets safer in their neighborhood, questions in regards to things such as do they wear their safety belts? Do they understand what the 0.08 blood alcohol content law is and what it means?
I'd love to see the data. I mean, I'd be fascinated to know if your message is being received, what message you're sending, and what questions you're pulling. But germane to this bill, Region 4, correct me, that's Central Oregon. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkinson, that is the central part of the state going from the Dalles through Bend down to the Klamath Falls.
So it's a corridor, it's a stripe. That's Highway 97 stripe.
Mr. Representative Atkinson, that's correct.
Another thought. What region and how did it pull across the board of age and sex? Did it pull in Eastern Oregon? I think that's Region 5. Is that Region 5?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, that is correct. Eastern Oregon would be considered Region 5. I didn't bring the data distribution part of the survey with me, but I'd be more happy to provide you, based on your interest, a full copy of the study that is split by region and by cluster.
I think we'd like to see that. I certainly get a lot of complaints from my constituents about the 65-mile-an-hour treatment in Oregon.
Oh. When you were going over the previous testimony, we were talking about the golden hour, right? If I can reflect back to that for just a moment. In analyzing those two data sets, do we have the differentiation between ambulances and helicopters?
Mr. Representative, I don't understand how to answer the question.
Well, the question is, in the metro area, if it's, would you say 29 minutes or something like that, and the rural area 59 minutes. We have a real problem in the rural area of being able not just for ambulance service, but also to afford helicopter service, for instance. In Central Oregon, there's a thing called AirLife. AirLife is well-funded, it's well-maintained, it's a good program, and it covers not as big a region as your strip for Region 4. But it covers about four counties and covers it very well. It's an effective program. You're familiar with it. I'll give you a briefing on it. Southern Oregon, we have a bigger population. We have just as remote, if not more remote areas in the sense of harder terrain to get to in many respects. We can't seem to fund our helicopter problem. What we have down there, it's called Mercy Flights. And I'm not sure how it is in the chairs district, but I think that plays an integral part, and I'm trying to, at least in my mind, see the correlation between your testimony of accidents, proximity to medical services, and the fact that in Eastern Oregon, perhaps you're flying a helicopter, and Metro Area, perhaps you're taking an ambulance. I'm sorry to be really wonkish on this, but surveys and this kind of data, I need to have everything out to really analyze it. So I guess that's more of a statement than a question. But if the question, I guess, would be, can you pull those apart and get in your testimony?
Mr. Chair, President Atkinson, the data set I'm referring to does not take into account the type of service provided. It is only based on the first individual from a crash scene that makes it to trauma center using the emergency medical services provided in the area. What type of transportation that is done at that time is not indicated.
Thank you very much. Further questions
for your witnesses? You care to comment on the fact that the highways are posted at 75 miles an hour in the early 70s?
The interstate highways were. Well, we had a question the other day about what the design fees were for the highways, and we did some research and found that the ODOT design manual does call for a 70-mile-an-hour design fee. I don't know in the cases of the highways that were posted back in the 70s for 75 miles an hour. I don't know who made those decisions. The interstate system, generally, we need a 70-mile-an-hour design speed. But there are exceptions. Clearly, the tool of the curves is one. Clearly, there are curves in southern Oregon where it's posted for less than that. It would have to be posted for less than that, even if the bill passes, just simply on the geometry and the design speed. So,
just to the two gentlemen, but the bill allows for that, does it not? I mean, I don't think the bill requires that any place be posted where ODOT believes that the design of the freeway would not support the speed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, that is correct.
All righty. Thank you, gentlemen. Grant Higginson.
Good evening, Chair Simmons, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Health Officer and Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Health Division. Eleanor Hall was here at the last public hearing and submitted the written testimony from the Health Division. I did not bring extra copies of that today, but we did want to be on the record as proposed in this bill. The Health Division mission statement is to protect, promote, and preserve the health of all Oregonians, and the bottom line for us is that speed does kill, and that we believe that this bill is in opposition to our mission. And you have already heard a number of people talk about the national studies, the studies from other states that have shown that with an increase in speed limits, there have been increasing number of deaths. With decreasing speed limits, there is a reduction in deaths. I also just wanted to share with you some Oregon-specific data to show you the significance of motor vehicle crash injuries in the state. Motor vehicle crashes continue to be the leading cause of injury deaths in the state of Oregon. Motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death for Oregonians aged 5 to 35 and remain a leading cause of death for all ages. In 1997, 522 people were killed and
35,400 were injured in traffic crashes, and over half of those fatal crashes in Oregon did involve speed. And I just bring this up because I think that, you know, what you're doing right now is coming to that balance of societal pressures versus public safety, and I think that decisions you're making here are just real critical ones. With that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Sure.
Mr. Higginson, you're the state health officer, right?
That's correct.
I just was wondering how you could be a state health officer and eat that big piece of meat you had last night at Horton's when I saw you at dinner.
Chair Simmons and Representative Williams, yesterday was my birthday.
Congratulations.
Thank you. My wife took me out, and I can assure you that that's not what I usually eat, and in fact, I suffered for it last night.
As did I.
Yeah.
As did I.
Representative Atkinson and Representative Jeff, happy birthday. First of all, happy birthday. Have you seen in your data, I recall in the 1970s the 55 State Saved Lives campaign, and I also recall just from school and policy papers, the whole debate that began Mr. Nader's campaign and career was Corvera. But as we have seen speed limits change, and we have also seen automobiles change. Do you have data that would suggest in the last 5 years that we've actually had safer cars, or does the data suggest we have just as many accidents now that we even have airbags?
Chair Simmons, Representative Atkinson, I would have to look further into that. I don't have those data on the tip of my tongue. I think that you're absolutely right, though, that the vehicles have become safer, and clearly seatbelts and airbags have been major safety devices. But still, the bottom line is, no matter how good the safety devices in those vehicles are, the faster people go, the more fatalities you're going to experience with the given set of technology that you have on hand. And because of that, I mean, we would continue to oppose an increase in the speed.
Your last comment about societal pressures, I think the auto industry is without doubt responded to societal pressures with safer vehicles, which I can afford one. I think at some point, though, we're going to, this whole debate will keep coming back with regards to when the society sets up with people doing the right thing for societal pressures. Excuse me.
This is Devin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I asked in your office for some information earlier this session, and a lot of it relates back to earlier consideration of similar bills, and I have some of the handouts that Mr. Kong provided at that time. I'm just trying to get to verify a couple of these statements. The chances of dying or being seriously injured in a crash doubles for every 10 miles per hour over 50 miles per hour.
Here's some questions on the gentleman. I would have to look that up again.
Yeah. And that was a statement, I believe, from Ms. Krenikin in her testimony at that time.
I think the issue actually that Representative Beyer raised unwittingly before is the issue of that exponential increase in the energies involved. You know, basic physics is energy equals mass times velocity squared. So when you increase that velocity, you're squaring that, and the energy does become much higher. So that a 10 mile per hour increase is going to give you a substantial increase in the energies involved in a crash.
Mr. Chairman, since we haven't had too much of this testimony, I just wanted to bring forward one other thing to the committee, and that is that so I can make some of this more available to the committee at a future hearing, should we have one, but there's a table here that shows at 70 miles per hour that an average vehicle low beam light illuminates about 160 feet, and at 70 miles per hour it takes 464 feet, presuming everything working normally, to stop.
I would guess that doesn't count reflected. You see things way out in front of you.
Yeah.
been reflected back to you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This whole discussion seems that the idea of personal responsibility can be a lot. When we talk about health issues, that I think seems to me that happens quite a lot. No comment on, you know, does a person have their own responsibility for, you know, for their actions, whether it's in a car or whether it's taking a cigarette to their lips?
Right. Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, I do believe that there is an element of personal responsibility here, and the issue was raised earlier about traffic conditions, I think, by the chair, and I certainly agree. I mean, even if the speeds are posted at 75 and the weather conditions are bad, you shouldn't be driving that fast, and there is a real personal responsibility issue there. However, you know, if you do make 75 the legal limit across the board on rural interstates, people are going to be driving faster. I mean, I just have no doubt of that, because I believe right now people are saying that the vast majority are driving 71 or under. So people are going to be driving faster, and the faster people drive, the more fatalities we're going to see. Regardless of how safe people try to be.
Mr. Higginson, thank you. People seem to be driving that fast already anyway. People travel 73 to 75, and I have received correspondence from people in my district. So, you know, and this is going over 75. I've never received a ticket if I was going under 75. And we are fostering an attitude of disregard for the law, I believe, for not making an adjustment to what people are already demonstrated that they are comfortable traveling. And I'm not seeing an outcry from other states that have a higher limit. I'm not hearing about increased carnage on their roadways from Idaho or some other states that have significantly higher limits than we do in Oregon. And I have here an article about out of California, higher speed limits and lower death rates. The statistics surprise many observers of state highways.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested in seeing what kind of data you're citing or using to back up for assertion that we are going to have more fatalities if increases speeding.
Right, and Chair Simmons, what I'm looking at right now is something from the Highway Loss Data Institute, and what they did was compare the experience of the states that had increased their speed limits in 1996, I believe. And they are estimating that there would be a 12 to 15% increase in the number of fatalities in other states if they chose to do similar. And so I think what we're seeing is, you know, if that plays out in Oregon, we would be talking instead of 500 deaths, 560 or 570 deaths. And I don't think that you're going to see, you know, a public outcry for that increased number of 50 deaths. But again, from the state public health agency's point of view, another 50 deaths, another 60 deaths, another 70 deaths is something we'd like not to see. And that's why we're in opposition to the bill.
Well, how do you respond to the fact that people are, in fact, traveling? They're already driving faster. They're already driving the speed that we would suggest that we posted.
Right. And Chair Simmons, again, that's not my experience. You know, I try to set my cruise control around 69 when I'm going, and I am passed by most people, but I'd say that's probably about the speed most other people are going around me. And, you know, when ODOT came up here before and said that their 85 percentile is 71 or lower, see, I would say that is my experience, that most people are driving 71 miles per hour or lower. And just because you set your speed limit at 75 doesn't mean that people are going to drive at 75. Right now, people are driving over 65 with a set of 75, and I think there's going to be that creep factor. If you add it to 75, that you're probably going to get people driving 80 and 82 as well.
Well, there are certainly all these exceptions, and you want to drive over in the right-hand lane then.
Chair Simmons, I try to travel in the middle lane most of the time.
All righty. Further questions for Mr. Higginson? Thank you very much. We will, anybody else in the audience who wants to testify today on Senate Bill 558?
If I may, Mr. Chair, I mentioned earlier Dr. Tung from Tualatin on his way, and it was just paged 10 minutes ago, and he said he was just south of Brooks. He started his trek at 1:30 to try and be here for this hearing.
The accident today, I guess.
The accident, yeah, his, the backlog, and if you would please just wait a few more minutes to see if he arrives, I would appreciate his ability.
All right. Yeah, we have some others we wanted to move if we get some members here and get it done. But Gardnersville and several others we wanted to move off the if we can get some more members here. And we need, have you seen the latest amendments to the ombudsman piece?
No, I haven't.
It takes out the indentation.
What is that? It takes out
the we had two revisions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one had a where we actually established the ombudsman office. Well, we'll stand at ease. There you go. We will come back to the order and open a public hearing on House Bill 3252. This is Representative Gardner's bill. Representative Gardner, do you want to give us an update?
Sure. Mr. Chair, community members, the original bill called for signature petition gathered for the residents of the state of Oregon, the -2 amendments we have before you, after consultation with legislative council, committee members, and many other interested parties, the 3252-2 amendments solely say that the petition gatherer shall be 18 years of age and a citizen of the United States, and I personally feel that these are reasonable limitations. They are not addressed in the Buckley decision. And certainly urge the committee support of the -2 amendment.
Sure. All right. Yes, Mr. Williams.
Representative Gardner, originally I thought we had talked about the citizen requirement being a citizen of the state of Oregon. Did you, I'm assuming you must have gotten advice from council that that was a problem?
Advice from legislative council was that both that could be published to the court as well as a citizen of the United States. I believe it was more compromise through the process that this one would be a citizen of the United States and work on that limitation.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Isn't that considered
Judge Gardner?
Yeah.
How many children are gathering signatures under the age of 18?
Well, none that I know of, Representative Atkinson, but with the Buckley decision and the removal of being a registered voter, part of the requirement of being a registered voter was that you had to be a certain age. There is no age limitation with the removal of that. Therefore, virtually there is, you know, you can have 2-year-olds gathering signatures under current law as far as incorporability.
Mm-hmm. Is anyone in the audience who wishes to testify today on the -2 amendments to House Bill 3252?
Mr. Chairman.
President Williams?
I support the -2 amendments as Representative Gardner has outlined and would so move those amendments.
All right, we'll open the work session. Representative Williams,
use the -2 amendments to House Bill 3252.
Colleagues, have a motion before us to move the -2 amendments to House Bill 3252. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the -2 amendments are moved to House Bill 3252. Representative Gardner, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3252 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner, colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 3252 goes to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Representative Gardner, you want to be the carrier?
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Writing. We will close the work session on House Bill 3252 and you can kind of write. I just make sure I have this for a moment to pause on the record. Okay. Let's go down now to House Bill 3285, open a public hearing. Ms. Moore.
Chairman and committee members, we're up to the batch, I would say 9.
10.
10. Let's see, do I have it?
Mr. Chair, is it your intent to move this bill tonight?
I think the dash 10 amendments is what they do is establish, they take out the language that established an ombudsman office and a lack of constitution by name, and solely leave it at a task force, legislative task force, to study the feasibility of establishing a legislative ombudsman office during the interim. And I would like to move the bill.
Is there a fiscal impact?
And the fiscal would be
some need to be revised with the last amendment.
Sure.
Yes.
Do we have a fiscal?
Do we have a revised? We don't have a revised.
Well,
I don't believe we have a revised fiscal.
There's not time to leave it.
Mr. Chairman.
This one, Devlin?
I would assume that given the fifth amendment, basically replaces the bill entirely.
It does.
And that basically what you would be funding is per diem for the 8 legislators that are on the committee, plus whatever staff resources they might need. That would be your fiscal.
Right, that's correct. And the staff we have on staff year round, we'd be using legislative policy and research staff that are kept on year round. Gardner?
Then, Mr. Chair, I assume that you're anticipating the fiscal to be under $50,000.
I am.
Okay.
Are we in work session?
No, we're not. I can open it. I want to get the sense of the members of the committee before we jump into work session. Let's endeavor.
Mr. Chairman, because representatives of the governor's office came to me and I believe came to the minority leader to discuss this bill several days ago and still voiced their opposition, but I see that the dash 10s are dated at least.
have expressed the same thing to me that the dash 9 included implementing the office in the last six, establishing the office in the last 6 months of the current biennium.
What I might suggest, Mr. Chair, it's your decision ultimately to bring this to a vote today, but what we could do is simply adopt the dash 10 amendment. Then we'd have a clean bill to deal with and bring it back when we have a full committee and when some of us have had a chance to confer with the governor's office to see if they're okay with that.
All righty. Are we in a work session this year?
No, we're not.
No, we're not yet in a work session. What will be? Yes, Mr. Williams?
I had reservations about the bill in its previous amended forms. I am probably just fine with dash 10. And my guess is most of the concerned members on the committee right now would probably be fine as well. But it may be wise to give them an opportunity to make sure that the bill, although maybe not, Mr. Chairman, we could. We could probably write this. The bill likely no longer suffers from a constitutional problem, Mr. Chairman.
Well,
although
I don't know.
It needs 7.
It needs 7.
Oh, that's true. Well, in that case, it probably still does. So it seems to make some sense to talk. Let them get some comfort level with the dash 10, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I think we'll do that.
My electronic is obviously going to tremendously watered down to just, you know, have everybody feel good. But we do have a habit of setting up lots of interim committees and task forces in this building for a whole range of issues, some more meritorious than others. And on that continuum, I guess I would put this one at the edge of the less meritorious.
end of the scale for task forces and interim committees. So, I mean, I'm inclined to just vote no as a symbolically, whether the governor cares or not. There are good things to set up interim committees on. I'm not sure this is one of them. I commend it, waste of time and energy.
All right. Thank you very much. That's coming back. What we're going to do is close the public hearing on House Bill 3285, and colleagues, you might take time to confer. I will bring this back as a courtesy to you.
Well, we'll just let you. I'm happy to.
We'll have a
work session on House Bill 3285.
And, Mr. Chairman, I move the Dastian Amendment. Okay, Representative Devlin moves the Dastian Amendment. Colleagues to House Bill 3285.
Yep.
Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm just not going to. I have not found any compelling reason to support the bill or the amendment. So I'm just.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to vote for the amendment because it effectively takes out the onerous and authoritative portions of the bill.
And I'll support the day.
I'm hearing the objections to moving the dash amendment to evaporate.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, seeing no objection to the dash amendment. They are adopted. And then we will close the work session on House Bill 3285 and move on to the elections that we've had on our calendar for some time. Senate Bill 368 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 368. I believe what we need to do actually have a bit of a work session on this.
I think we're ready for work session. Mr. Chair,
open a work session for Senate Bill 368A. Wilson as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the most, I think it's most, is it basket sevens we're looking at here?
They've been distributed to the committee. I'm
trying to figure out what they
are. Eight?
Yeah, because we're going to have eight out today.
Seven and eight.
5, 6, 7, and 8 is what we want. So, Mr. Chair, I move the dash 5 amendment to House 368.
Chair?
Yes,
Mr. Chair. I vote dash 5 will be in the bill.
It works.
Sure. We were adopted on 14999.
We got them in there?
So,
yep. Okay. I was in the dash 6s. Remove that. First, we go to Mr. Chair, move the dash 6. Amendment to this.
Dash 6 amendments change the date for Secretary of State to prepare voters' pamphlets on the 15th to the 20th day, authorize Secretary of State to prescribe methods for distributing the voters' pamphlets.
And Ms. Seelock, you okay with this Dash 6 amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Calling for a motion before us to move the Dash 6 amendments into Senate Bill 368A. Any discussion?
That's fine.
We're kind of seen none, so
somebody wanted to.
Do you want to testify on the dash sixes?
I want to testify.
Okay, do we have people in the audience who wish to testify today?
What do you have?
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Matthew Donahue. I'm representing myself, the Coalition for Initiative Rights and the Pacific Green Party of Oregon. We oppose SB 368 on the grounds that it creates several instances where we will be raising the price of voter pamphlet space while at the same time reducing the amount of space available in the voter's pamphlet for certain types of statements. A few instances, this is from the rules in the current 1997-1998 election laws. From those laws, SB 368 would reduce the size and length of the president, vice president, U.S. senatorial, and representative candidate space from 59.6 inches and 900 words to 30 square inches and 325 words, while increasing the cost from $500 to $1,000. Increase the state senator, representative, and other non-statewide office candidate space from $100 to $300. Reduce the voter pamphlet space for state office candidates to be voted for in the state at large from 59.6 square inches and 900 words to 30 square inches and 325 words, while increasing the cost of this space from $300 to $1,000. It would also reduce the size of political party or assembly of electors space in the voter pamphlet from a maximum of 119.2 square inches down to 60 square inches, while increasing the cost from up to $600, which would be up from a $400 maximum for that space. The bill would also reduce the space for the space for less than a statewide political party or assembly of electors from 59.6 square inches down to 30 square inches, while increasing the cost of the space to $300, up from $200. It would also increase the cost of support or opposition statements for the statewide measures in the voter's pamphlet from $300 or 1,000 elector signatures to $500 or 2,500 elector signatures, while offering no significant increase in size. And also, the bill would allow the Secretary of State discretion in establishing the size of opposition or support statements regarding initiatives. And regarding the maximum of 30 inches, it sets no minimum, which means Secretary of State could essentially decide whatever he wanted or she wanted regarding square inch and word space on a support or opposition statement, and as long as it did not exceed 30 square inches, it would be consistent with this bill. We just believe at this point, particularly given that our initiatives process has expanded in size. Last, in the 1998 elections, we had a large amount of initiatives that covered a broad range of topics. There's a large diversity of opinions and political viewpoints in this state. There is a lot of grassroots organization in agricultural communities, in environmental communities, in labor rights communities. These individuals have a lot of grassroots support. They do not, however, have a lot of money. Yet they do have opinions that are valid and that we believe are beneficial to be put out into the political community prior to voting on these initiatives. We also believe that, particularly regarding initiatives, it's incumbent upon voters and with candidates as well. I mean, in the last election, we set a record, $12.4 million regarding legislative fundraising. I've got to tell you folks about that. We also had the lowest voter turnout in history. We broke our 1979 record from 65% went down to 59% of registered voters participating. I believe, and we believe, what this bill would do would be to increase the amount of money that individuals, candidates, political parties would have to raise in order to gain access to the voter's pamphlet, while at the same time decreasing the amount of space that these individuals and candidates and political parties would have to get their points of view across. I've spoken with many individuals about this, and many people rely on the voter's pamphlet as one of their major sources for in-depth debate regarding opposition support on initiatives and also regarding candidate investigation. Many people are completely dissatisfied with what they're receiving from radio and television media. It provides them with very little in the way of candidate positions and in-depth candidate philosophies. The voter's pamphlet, they found, is an excellent resource for this. They do not wish to see it reduced in size to the point where that information that can be provided in the space that is determined by the Secretary of State or by this SB 368 comes to mirror the soundbite-driven public media information that they receive. And as a result of all these things that I have raised, what we're requesting is that SB 368 be changed to strike from it any language that would increase the cost for any voter's pamphlet space, reduce the size for any voter's pamphlet space, or give the Secretary of State any discretion in and above what he has at this point in the current Oregon election laws to set by rule space size in the voter's pamphlet. And any questions?
Mr. Donahue, are you aware that the changes in the Senate Bill 368 were first adopted in the
1995 legislative session?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. These, I realize these changes were implemented for the 94 and 96 campaigns. However, at that time, we opposed them as well as excessive, and continue to oppose those as excessive, and at this point are giving input. Yes, I have talked with the Secretary of State's office. They did inform me that the 1997 special election and this 1998 election were the only two current elections that were regulated regarding voter sample size in the current election laws. And we believe that the current election laws reflect an adequate size and an adequate cost for space for these voter pamphlet submissions.
Okay. Devin, do you have a question?
No.
I am sympathetic to your concerns, but I have to say the testimony we've had is that with all of these changes, we're still not paying for our voters' pamphlets, and so there is a cost to having that publication in place, and there is a cost to being able to be in that publication. I've experienced that. We've all experienced that. So I don't know how you would address that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fierce, I recognize cost is an issue. However, in the state, we spend a significant amount of tax money on roads. We spend a significant amount of tax money on education. We spend a significant amount of tax money on prisons, on health care. This voter's pamphlet, and I don't think this is an overestimation, this voter's pamphlet is probably the main resource for most Oregon voters regarding their in-depth, their ability to examine in-depth issues on the initiatives and to investigate the candidates. The chair mentioned earlier Measure 64. Measure 64 was an initiative that generated a considerable amount of opposition and support statements. I believe that many people gave Measure 64 the kind of attention that they did when they voted because they saw the voters' pamphlet and because they saw that many opposition and support statements. So as I believe it is pretty much a necessary part of our democratic process. If we're going to use tax dollars for roads, we're going to use tax dollars for prisons, health care, and education, and yet we are not going to use tax dollars to ensure that we have a sound democratic process and that we have an informed electorate and that we have an open process where we're not excluding individuals from political discourse based on a reasonable price. I believe that we're making a serious error, and so do the organizations I represent.
Mr. Donahue, I think the Church's point was that the increased fees do not eliminate the state subsidy at all, but they do reduce it.
Oh, sure, I understand.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you very much for coming today. Is Mr. Filler Drying available?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as has been said, my name is Philard Ryan. I'm here representing myself. While I oppose the bill, I wanted to focus on one specific aspect of it, and that is raising the number of signatures that is necessary for a support or opposition statement in the voter's pamphlet. It seems to me that if there is a group out there somewhere that is poor enough and has broad enough support, to feel that it's easier to go out and get 1,000 signatures than to pay $500 for a voter's candidate, for a voter's pamphlet statement, then the law should encourage them to speak and should enable them to be heard. I would even suggest lowering it from 1,000 to 500 or a number like that.
Thank you.
How would you feel about this if the one thing we did change was the number of elector signatures for the voter's pamphlet on measures? At 2,500 signatures versus $500 seems to be cheapening the value of the signatures, whereas it used to be at $300 or $1,000. Does that help? I mean, I know there's a lot of other issues that you have, but does that help any?
I'm sorry, the very beginning of what you said.
Right, we're talking about increasing the support or opposition statements from $300 to $500.
Right.
That's one thing. That's the money's interest for whomever. The other side is they're saying we're moving from 1,000 signatures to 2,500 electric signatures. And I'm wondering, on that piece of the equation, why are we adding that many more signatures to get a statement in? If 1,000 voters want to give a statement, maybe why do we need to move to 2,500? I'm wondering if at least we adjusted that. Is that some value to folks who may want to get, who can't, don't have a lot of money but want to get a statement in the voter stamp?
I would agree that retaining the number of signatures at 1,000 is better than raising it to 2,500. Am I addressing your point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Ryan.
Thank you
very much. This is the third time we have actually taken public comment on Senate Bill 368. We have had other testimony on the bill. We'll reopen the work session.
Mr. Chairman?
President Nance, yes.
Have we already adopted all of the amendments?
No, we have not. We adopted the
Then
we adopted the Dash 6s.
I'm at your service, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any more that you want to adopt?
Yes. And Representative Welch had another amendment related to cannabis. Two more.
Yes. I'd like, Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash A7 to Senate Bill 368.
Are these your amendments? Okay. Would you...
Seven and eight.
Could you give us an update on these amendments, please?
That seven amendments, option for local and special district candidates to file in state voters' pamphlet, and option for local measure in state voters' pamphlet.
If you want further explanation, we do have experts here.
Are the local officials here in support?
They are here in support. Worked with them, and they worked with the Secretary of State's office, Colleen Kulak. So we could get up.
Yeah, we'd be pleased for Sloan. Colleen and some of the local districts and counties would be good.
And that's Lane County?
Yes. Okay. I have some questions about this. How's this going to, this opens it up to special districts, which would be irrigation districts, it would be, clarify for me.
Chair Simmons, for the record, I'm Colin Kulak, I'm the director of the Washington Secretary. The only district that is allowed is the Metropolitan Service District, the Metro Service District. There are no special districts covered in this bill. What this bill does, it would allow county commissions and other county officials, council majors, city majors, excuse me, not city majors, city offices or city campuses where the city population is over 50,000 to participate in the state voter campus if they do not have a local county voter campus being produced. So if they have a local county voter campus, like you would have in most of the metropolitan area of Portland, then they would be foreclosed from being in the state pamphlet and can only be in the county pamphlet. You remember Josephine County had an incident where they talked about a sheriff who raced a gut to. So Josephine County, they would only be eligible to be in that county voter pamphlet. In Lane County, where they do not produce a Lane County voter pamphlet, all of the counties would be eligible to be in the state
pamphlet. Alrighty. If a person's district overlaps several counties and one of the counties covers the voter sample and the other one doesn't, if the state voter sample covers the whole area, how will it work?
Chair Simmons, the way the bill is drafted, that person would file in both places, both of the one county where there is a local pamphlet produced and with the state, and we would coordinate with the county and print it only in the county version, depending on whether or not we have some
counties in the state that get different voters' pamphlets so that you might appear in numerous state editions. For example, we might have one that just goes to Basin County, another one that goes to Umatilla County. In fact, those don't even border, but using that just as an example, let's assume that Umatilla County was printing a pamphlet, your statement would appear in that voter's pamphlet. If Basin County did not print the voter's pamphlet, then your statement would appear in the state Basin County edition.
So the potential for this confusion, as in Josephine County, is still there?
Sheriff Simmons, no, it is not.
Not at all.
Not at all. They would have to be in the Josephine County pamphlet only and would be precluded from being in the state voter's pamphlet.
Okay. Further questions from the committee on the A7 amendments to Senate Bill 368? Just one question, Gardner.
All right, it's not on the A7 amendments, but on the original bill, if I may.
There was a little bit of discussion here about the 2,500 signatures. Just wanted to ask a real quick question. How many people actually go out and get, it was previously 1,000. How many people put a statement in by getting 1,000 signatures?
Sheriff Simmons, Representative Gardner. I do not know. There's very few. There's only, if I remember right, we might have had two last time in 1996 when the number was higher. I think we had four. We were from the same organization, so that what happened is when they circulated for the purpose of gathering signatures, they were circulating based on four different arguments, so they just had people signing four different sheets. I can certainly find that because we have that detailed. In fact, I have the voters' pamphlet. I don't have a major version. It's identified even in the pamphlet itself. The bottom line reads, this was paid for by a fee of, or this measure was submitted by petition circulation. So we have that information available. I don't have it with me. I suppose you can make the argument if a lot of people didn't use a signature gathering, you don't need to be concerned about it. I think conversely, you could say if only a few did, why not make it available to those who want to go out and get those 1,000 signatures as a way of not being able to participate without having paid that amount. So I think that would be worth consideration in this bill. I'd be fine with taking it down from the 2,500 signatures down to the, just eliminate that 25 and have 2,000.
Ms. Inbuyer.
Question for Ms. Seelock. The 95 or the 93 bill that passed, was it this, the number, 2,500?
Sheriff Simmons, Representative Byer, that's correct. That number was set by, I believe this bill started in 1982 in the Senate side. There was much discussion about raising it. They were looking at trying to just match the dollar ratio, and so that if it went up about half, increased injury, you're just going to have to do it. And at some point, the committee themselves was really wanted to come up with the answer, because that's what we started in.
Other questions from the committee? Did you have a comment on the A7?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Flanger, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I think the A7 takes us about as far as we can get under the circumstances, Mr. Chair, to address the county issues. And it's a big improvement over what the printed bill did. The county does not print its voter pamphlets, and this applies to those counties to give them a chance to be in the state voter's pamphlet. That's much better for us.
So what represented well to get a motion?
Already before.
Okay. So motion for us to adopt the A7 amendment to the Senate Bill 368. Is there any discussion? Further discussion, any objection? Hearing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair. Adopt the -8A8 amendment to Senate Bill 368.
Chair, this is Jack Agel for Caucus. Senate Bill 1178 and the -8 amendment.
Okay. So you've heard the explanation from committee staff. Is there any discussion?
Any objections? Hearing none, the dash 8 amendments are adopted. And let's see, Kirsty, did you have a...
Yeah, I'd make a conceptual amendment to, I don't know where it is in the bill, so you're going to have to tell me.
That would be on page 8, line 13, is that what you're looking for?
I think you're probably on it.
I can't find even the bill, right?
Line 13 in the original
bill.
So we would, I think it's on page 8, line 16, is that correct?
16.
Contain the signatures of 2,500 electors here.
Line 16.
Yeah. Place that with 1,000.
Not for, isn't that the bill?
It's currently 1,000, isn't that correct, Ms. Seabot?
So we would keep it.
That's what it shows on line 6, on last page 8.
Yeah, 1,000 there.
Yeah, the language that was removed at the top, and then down line 16,
mm-hmm.
New language includes 2,500 electors eligible to vote on the measure.
So I can session move it back to being
1,000.
The
conceptual amendment, I think we need unanimous consent to suspend the rules for purposes of consideration of the conceptual amendment. Any objection? Okay, so you've got a motion before us from the conspiracy to contest it in line 16.
Page 8,
line 16 of the bill, the A and Growth bill, reducing the 2,500 to 1,000. Is there any further discussion on the amendment, the motion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. You noted that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Welsh. I move Senate Bill 368 as amended, conceptually amended, to forward the due path recommendation.
Colleagues have motion before us to move the Senate Bill 368A as amended and conceptually amended to forward the due path recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? See none. Here's the floor. We do pass this recommendation. Volunteer for carrier.
Mr. Chairman, Bill.
There you go. I thought I saw Representative Piercy volunteering.
Oh, yeah. My eyebrow go up.
Yeah. I thought that was a young chair. Didn't see it.
I'd do it for you.
I'm sure I may have an opportunity to carry 2007 and some of those others that we're working on. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 368, and what else do we have we need to clear up the 3516. Yeah, we have opened up some more public testimony on the Stephen McPhee. So let's go into work session.
I'm not sure you're going to do that one.
Our house is 3516. Is anybody signed up, Kevin? Would you give us an overview?
House Bill 3516. Committee members, Mr. Chair, we have received from ours the amendments dash 1, dash 2, dash 3. The bill modifies expenditure reporting requirements for people supporting or opposing political campaigns. The dash 1 amendments require candidates, political committees, and chief petitioners who file political contribution expenditure statements, the Secretary of State to file statements electronically. Its full amount of contributions expenditures exceed $10,000 for a single election. Specifies rules for filing, specifies operative dates.
Because these amendments are prepared separately for your consideration today, the dash 2s and dash 3s. The dash 3s are the electronic filing piece. It's
the same one.
Mm-hmm. And there's no one signed up to testify today. Is anyone in the audience who wishes to testify?
People just
Yes, this is Beck.
Do any of these amendments
remove the original language of the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Devlin.
After careful review of the amendments, I find that they do not. And I will leave it up to the discussion of the committee of whether or not we want to remove the original provisions of the bill.
Ms. Elock.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colleen Kulak. I'm the director of elections. I just wanted to clarify the dash one amendments, the original electronic filing. We did discover a slight problem with them in that we wanted to make sure that there was enough time in which to develop our own electronic filing system. Mm-hmm. And likewise, if any candidate would have a problem with it, that it gives them an out for the first 2 years by coming to us and telling us or determining for us how they would be impracticable to adhere to. So I wanted to just clarify that our position would be adopting this bill with the dash 2 and the dash 3 amendments and leaving the dash 1s on this.
The dash 3 is the...
Just the corrected version of the dash 1.
Okay. Let's move back.
Colleen, where did the $10,000 come from?
Chair Simmons, Representative Beck, we attempted to say at what point would a committee be able to probably already be owning a computer and the size of a campaign that
okay.
was
This is Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, we are in work session.
We are in work session.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is to move some of the amendments and then to bring the question forward to the committee about the original item in the bill. To the committee, which is there. I move the dash 2 amendment.
Well, I'm calling the motion before us to move the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3516. Any discussion? Mm-hmm. Any objections? Seeing hearing none, the dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I move the dash 3 amendment.
I have a motion to move the dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3516.
Mr. Chair, I will object to the dash 3 amendment. This requires a candidate to file electronically, even though it has a 2-year period. I don't believe we should be requiring them to until we have the format ready and in place. And I think there are many candidates who don't use a computer for that particular purpose. And I just don't feel that this is quite an idea that's quite at its time yet.
Mr. Chair, this is Byer.
Ditto.
Whoops.
Mr. Chairman. Probably won't get a lot of argument out of
this. Mr. Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, since these amendments reflect bills that have actually already passed the Senate,
Well, I believe actually the electronic filing piece was heard.
Oh, that did not.
And the chair thinks it's a pretty good idea.
But I'm seeing that there are only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 members.
Yes.
Are you a member?
No, we're not going
to vote. We're going
to get some votes.
We're going to around the building for some votes. Mr. Chairman,
yes,
I do find if Ms. Seelock would like to come forward, if that would be okay with the chair.
Ms. Seelock, please.
Let
me see. Mr. Devlin.
Mr. Simmons, Representative Kirstie, that is the reason we wanted the additional language put in, giving both us the ability to say we aren't quite ready, as well as to give candidates in that first 2-year window who aren't ready, but basically leaving in place the mandate for the year 2002.
We're very optimistic that we will be in a place that we will be able to showcase it for the September supplemental, so people needing to file there and have it fully in place for the primary in the year 2000. Again, under the bottom of page 1, subsection 3, that carries over to the top of page 2, talks about anybody who believes that it is impracticable for them to use this in the year 2000 would simply request an excuse from us.
That's all.
Yes, that's the first excuse.
And if they made that request, is that only in the year 2000 is that they could make that request, and after that they have to be up to speed?
Chair Simmons, Representative Kiersey, that is correct. That that ability goes away by the bill.
Right.
And in fact, it's Section 8, the waiver granted under this section, I'm reading from page 2, line 20, shall not extend beyond the year January 1st, 2002, but would be in place for the primary in the year 2002.
And it's your belief that people will be able to comply with that by that time?
Chair Simmons, Representative Kiersey, the way that we're trying to design the system, that would not take special software, you'd be able to use whatever software you currently have, and that we find most of the communities at this level are already electronically tracking their contribution and expenditures. But for those communities that are not using computers, the waiver goes away in the year 2002 under this bill.
So this language allowed to kind of be phased in over time. This is Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Seeloff, can the committees that wish to do so currently file electronically without this bill?
Chair Simmons, Representative Byers, we have no capability to accept that filing electronically now. We hope to have that available, and I suppose they could if they prepared their electronic format in the way that it could be downloaded to our system.
All up. This is Barr. Do you need a bill to allow committees to do that?
Chair Simmons, Representative Byers, no.
One more then, Mr. Barr. This is more directed to the committee, I guess. I guess my feeling is we don't need a bill to allow committees to do this. I'm pretty sure there'll be a legislative session between now and January 1, 2002, that if we wish to make it mandatory, if it all works good, that we can bring this issue up again at that time. And it seems to me we'll have a session sometime in 2001. Unless YTK wipes us all out or something. I don't know.
I guess I would look at it a little differently in that we have another session in between. If there's a problem, we could always extend the time out. I think we need to, these things do take time. We should have had this by now. I mean, this should have been in place, and I think we haven't pushed the Secretary of State's office enough over the last half a dozen years to get there. I think the only way they're going to get there is if we give them some lead time, we put it in statute, we kick their fannies a little bit, and if by next session it'd be clear the technology isn't available or the money or who knows, we'll have a new Secretary of State by then. All kinds of reasons we can revise at that time. So I think this is time of it's time to get moving on electronic filing.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, we still have two no votes on it. Would the, I think we're in, set relatively informal here. We changed the date under which that you could no longer get an exception to 2004.
I'd probably be preferable with 2020 or so.
Yeah, he's electronic.
And I assume you send your own email today.
I do.
I suggest we, I shouldn't assume, but I'm assuming that my colleagues on the right and the left would like to have a chance to vote on this, and maybe we just put this off.
for another day. I think they're gone.
Yeah. We have already adopted the dash twos, we have the dash threes before us, and we have, I think, one, two, three, four, maybe five votes, I think, in favor.
We need seven.
Yeah, we need seven votes in favor to do that. What we could do, we have brought this forward, rather than starting all over the bill and finding some people. And next week, Thursday session, at least I expect we'll be meeting for a very brief time because of an impending floor session. We'll start again at 4 or 5 on Thursday. But we will set this over then until Thursday and allow members an opportunity to digest and develop some comfort level with the dash 3 amendments, with the phase-in period, and can visit with Colleen Seelock and the Secretary of State's Elections Division. And we'll get back to time. Mr. Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment also, I'll make an effort to talk to the committee members and to see what their preference is about the original content of the bill, which we have not changed. And if I might briefly explain, this is a bill that was introduced in the last legislative session. It was basically a ghost bill that was put in as a potential bill to you do vote by mail with. So we looked for the minor provision that we could find that would give us a relating clause relating to elections. All that the original bill does is raise the figure from $50 to $100, where you have to, over $100, where you have to start reporting detailed information about contributors. I do want to find out where the committee is on that. It would be easy to take that original content out of the bill. It would be easy to leave it in there also. So I'll do that before it comes back.
Yeah, it certainly is a public policy decision on the original language. It makes it easier when you're tracking and collecting contributions, but there's also the public disclosure question. And you certainly need to be aware of and maintain full faith with the people who are.
And Mr. Chairman, although I know that there is a relative issue here, that $100 limit is what the current status is for statewide candidates. They don't have to provide details according to the revenue.
Okay. So there's precedent for it in current law. All righty. Thank you very much. We'll close this on the screen. We'll check them out. All that remains today is to finish out some public testimony on Senate Bill 558. We will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 558. I believe we have an individual who's driven down from. Okay, hey, thank you for coming today.
Okay.
Here we have a witness here. Yes, please introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Chairman, members, I admire your stamina and your sense of humor this evening. My name is John Tyne. I'm an orthopedic surgeon from Tualatin, Oregon.
Mr. Tyne, how do I spell your last name?
T-O-M-G-U, like tongue in your mouth.
Okay, and thank you.
Speaking as chair of the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, which advises the traffic safety section of ODOT, we had our meeting here in Salem this morning. I tried to get back to my office in Tualatin to see seven patients and come back and testify here at 3:30 and saw the truck on Boone Bridge on my way up and then spent 4 hours trying to get back to testify and apologize for being late. It seems somewhat significant that a death on I-5 occurred today on the work zone. And this bill relates to the safety of the interstate roads.
asking to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 558, as I did 2 years ago when it was in the House Transportation Committee. The information that I'm passing out in graphic form, hopefully this late in the day, will be eye-catching and interesting to you. The first is the bar graph showing what happened to deaths on the interstate the last time we raised interstate speeds, and the deaths the 3 years preceding the change from 55 to 65 was 28 per year. The 3 years following that change, 46 per year. And then the safety belt law came into effect and reduced the deaths. So that was a significant increase. The next point I'd like to make is that when you increase velocity, remember that the energy increases with the square of the velocity. So I'll make a couple other comments, but about some generalizations. But the physics that Senator Miller alluded to still hold, and we agree on that at least that point. The next graphic is the ODOT survey, which was done 3 years ago, showing that 62% of Oregonians oppose raising interstate speeds above 65. That survey is now out of date because it was repeated last summer, and the figure is now 67% opposed. And the interesting thing to me, Representative Simons, knowing that you're from east of the Cascades, is that right?
Yes, it is.
340 miles away, I think you said,
mm-hmm.
is that the breakdown is, the demographics show that the opposition is actually greater in eastern Oregon than it is here in the Willamette Valley. The trauma death rates, by the way, and I'll try not to allude to too many statistics, are 10 times greater per population in the rural areas of Oregon than they are here in the Willamette Valley. So that may be part of that background. And then I've included one national study from the Insurance Institute. Their survey shows a substantial increase in deaths. I know that Senator Miller has discredited the studies from the Insurance Institute and from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, but I believe that they are credible studies and deserve your attention. The next handout is a statement from Dr. Colin Cater, former chairman of the State Trauma Advisory Board in opposition. He wrote the statement without a single statistic, and I think there's some good writing there if you would like to pursue that. So the State Trauma Advisory Board, the emergency room physicians of the state and orthopedic surgeons of the state of Oregon, as well as the governor of the former practicing emergency room physician of the state of Oregon, opposed this bill. And, of course, that has to do with our direct experience with highway trauma. I've written a op-ed piece that was published in the Oregonian 2 years ago, and the statistics in that and the arguments in that still hold. This is the physics of death on our roadways have not changed. One of the hard things for me to understand was how increasing posted speeds affects the risk on the roadway. If you increase the speed on a given highway that is 50 miles an hour or greater in terms of average speed traveled, you increase that average speed traveled by 10 miles per hour, the deaths on that same roadway will increase by 100%. That figure comes from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration as an accepted point of information. That means, however, that if you increase the average speed traveled on a given roadway by only 1 mile per hour, that the death rate on that roadway will increase by 10%. It's pretty hard to understand it, to accept perhaps, but that's true. And the increase in the average road speed, you'll see in the graphic that shows the changes that occurred in I think I handed it out to you, but it shows the increase in the crossover effect on the secondary roads
is a major point that actually, when we increased our speeds in 87, that people become velocitized on the interstate roads, and we had more deaths on the adjacent roads. The impact was greater on those roadways than it was even on the interstate roads, and I think that that's something that I didn't know 3 or 4 years ago that I've studied and become to believe is kind of an unknown, significant, stark reality of the effect of changing the posted speeds on the interstate roads. So we had an actual increase in total deaths of 38, not 16, which was, if you include the secondary roads. So raising speeds is opposed by the people, is opposed by the physicians who treat the injuries, and I would urge you to oppose the bill that would allow an increase in posted speeds on the rural interstate. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Also, I'd point out that nationwide, the average state has about 4% of the vehicle miles traveled on their interstate system. In Oregon, that figure is 9%. So we have a high figure there, and we enjoy the fact that our interstates are among the safest roads that we travel, and we travel them relatively frequently compared to other states. So this would have a greater impact on us, perhaps, than some other states.
Mr. Tom, Dr. Tom, what would be your reaction to a bill that just gave ODOT the authority to set speed limits rather than mandated what that limit should be? Would you be advocating to lower it back to 55 then, or would you be supportive of moving it to 70?
I would be in support of maintaining the speed limit where we have it at 65, which the public is comfortable with. Raising the speed limits from 55 to 65, according to a statement by Captain Stevenson, written 2 years ago when he was the Highway Patrol Captain, he stated that raising the speed limit in 87 cost us 3,400 lives in the state of Oregon. So there was a cost to that. But I don't believe that the public support an additional cost. We had 538 deaths last year. Commercial aviation traveling hundreds of millions of miles last year in this nation had zero deaths. I don't believe that these deaths are the price that we must pay to have a mobile society in our state. I believe that 90% of these deaths are behavior-related, and that we can modify that behavior by getting more people buckled up, fewer people drinking and driving, and have better law enforcement of the speed limits that we have now.
Mm-hmm. What's the most recent data? What are the current trends in highway fatalities that you have access to? With the higher quality safe equipment in cars, with the seatbelt law that we have in place? Do you have any data newer than 93?
Yes, sir. The deaths per vehicle mile traveled have continued to decline because of the safer cars. But I believe that the real opportunity is in the three-legged stool of speed, safety belt, and the issue of impaired driving. I think we're over-invested in engineering and under-invested in enforcement of the laws that we have here in the state of Oregon, which are good laws. Does that answer your question? The number of deaths increased from 512 the year before last to 338 or 39 last year. And as of this point today, we're about 6% less than we were at this point a year ago in terms of the numbers of deaths. The numbers of vehicle miles traveled in the last 30 years has tripled. So since I began working on traffic safety issues in the early 80s, it's become approximately twice as safe to travel a vehicle mile in the state of Oregon. But, of course, we're traveling so many more miles, the numbers of deaths haven't changed very much. But there's a huge opportunity there to reduce those deaths.
There's tremendous amount of a lot more exposure because of the increased miles traveled.
Yes, sir.
But even with that, we're seeing currently 6% less than what we had
at this time a year ago. But those numbers bounce around, and
today was a bad day.
Right. Questions in the committee? I will now close conversation. I think Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Cohen, when we get into this discussion about how the, well, the forces, the kinetic energy that's involved, I guess the statement doubles every, at a certain level, like every 10 miles per hour that you're traveling, or it's tigorous in one day, it's been a long day.
It does, it doubles.
Yes. Have you seen any studies that, I don't really want to get into graphic detail, but to give you some idea about what the impact of that is relative to occupants of the vehicle?
Yeah, the G-forces are tremendous. They approach 90 Gs in deceleration forces. Working in emergency rooms, I've seen unbelievable, horrible trauma to the human head and the torso from these kind of forces. The increase in the force is shielded in part by the safer cars, but we, I think it's a false logic to say that we can have, you know, we can have inadequate law enforcement and inadequate education and continue to overinvest in engineering while we suffer the rate of the numbers of deaths that were and injuries. There are approximately 100 injuries for every death, so I'm only talking about the deaths because that's where we have the best data, and that's the number that everyone can be comfortable with in terms of reality. But it's, I see the people in my office who literally cannot have their operations because they're caring for a loved one at their home who has a closed head injury that you and I never see in society. The trauma to the fabric of the families in our communities, and destroying families because of these serious injuries which are disabling. We have over 1,000 closed head traumas like that every year in the state of Oregon. It's a silent epidemic that we never talk about. So the real damage is greater, I think, to the severely injured than it is to those who die, to the families.
Any questions from the committee?
Chairman.
Mr. Beck.
I just want to thank Dr. Tung for coming down here and for the fidgety, restless day for a lot of us, and we appreciate your service and your compelling testimony and reminder and let you know your words haven't fallen on deaf ears even after
all day.
Three hours in this room and other hours in another room. So thank you for coming down here and taking the time.
I would have a final line of thought to pursue here. It seems to me that people are traveling 70 to 75 already up on the interstate, yet at least when I get east of the Dalles, there seems to be little reason people shouldn't be traveling. The traffic is lighter. It's not like the corridor between here and Portland where there's three lanes of traffic on it. Almost bumper to bumper. It's not like down in L.A. and places, but the traffic volume is certainly significantly greater. Get out east and on over into Idaho. There may be a few places in the mountains where it ought to be slower, but it seems to me that there is some justification with the people already traveling at 70 to 75 miles an hour in our deaths being down, as you indicated, 6% from this time last year. Why don't we adjust the law to what people are already doing, and particularly in areas such as out east on the interstate?
That gets to Senator Miller. I'm a constituent of Senator Miller. To his point that the public is smart, and the public is smart, and they know that they can travel down I-5 or large parts of I-84
at 71, 72 miles an hour, and that is perhaps even a little higher when they get east of the Dalles and not be bothered. Mm-hmm. So if you increase the speed to 70 or to 75, what will the margin be?
Well, I'm not convinced that there will be. When I travel over into Idaho, where the speed limit is 75, people aren't going 85. They seem to have found a comfort zone around 70, 75, and they kind of cruise along. And I don't see as many people, in my experience, heading down to Boise that are just flagrantly violating the speed limit.
Well, I think if you look at the handout I gave you when the rural interstate increased 10 miles per hour on all rural interstates in 87, that the actual speeds in the first 3 years only increased, I think, 3.2 miles per hour. But the point I was trying to make is that very slight increase is very deadly. And even though you may not see a perceptible difference in Idaho, they may have better law enforcement capability than we have, but they certainly have higher speeds. And the difference of a few miles per hour in speed is not only important on the interstate, but also in the secondary roads off of those interstates, as I tried to point out, which is something that I learned studying this data that I didn't know about 3 years ago. And the public is satisfied with the situation that we have. And I don't think that the public is responding in a disrespectful manner. I don't think the public is feeling that the laws that we have are in some way we're also going to increase the variance of speeds if we increase posted speeds. So the people who are driving at lower speeds are still going to continue to do that. So I think that's going to aggravate the situation. But the main thrust of my argument is that if we increase posted speeds, that there will be a smaller increase in the average vehicle mile traveled, and that will increase the deaths not only on the interstates, which are the safest roads we have, but tremendously increase the risk on the secondary roads, which are five times more dangerous per mile to travel on.
But if people are already traveling at the speed we would post it up to?
My argument would be then that if you posted at 75 east of the Dalles, people would be going over 80.
Have you considered the fact that we are making every effort to budget for an additional 100 state troopers to enforce them?
Yes, I had a chance to talk to a state police officer at our meeting this morning about that, and he tells me that of those 100 additional officers, that represents less than one quarter of the gap analysis recommendation that they had made, and that only 55 of those officers would be dedicated to freeway patrol or have freeway patrol assignments, and they only work 40 hours a week. So the actual change in the perception of enforcement, which is what really affects the average speed traveled, I think would be very small. And in the governor's letter, which you read, he discounts that increase, I think, in the language of his letter, stating that he does not feel that change in enforcement would cover the difference in the increased risk to our population.
Alrighty. Well, so the questions from the committee. Thank you very much for coming today. And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 558. And student other business for the committee. I didn't forget anything, did I? We are adjourned. Thank you, Kitty.